Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome back to The Sit Down, a crime and mafia podcast. Hope you're all having a great day wherever you are. We are back here for another episode. Really looking forward to this one. We've got a lot to get into. You know what? The first couple episodes have been great. Really enjoyed doing this show, and I've gotten a lot of great feedback, which is great. We all know the mob is a fascinating group of people, a fascinating triumvirate of America. So I'm happy to continue to do it, and I'm glad people are here and enjoying it. Let's bring in our consigliere, Blackjack Fletcher. Hey, Blackjack, how are you?
What's happening, buddy? How we doing?
Good to have you. Good to have you. Had some good shows so far, and I'm really looking forward to this one. We got a really fascinating show, and actually, it kind of relates all back to present day, and I'm going to tell you why at the end of the show. But there's a lot to unpack in this episode. We're going to talk about the mafia cops, Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa, two guys that really, when you look at police corruption, may have been the most corrupt individuals in the history of American law enforcement. Now, as a former attorney, Blackjack, did you ever come across any dirty cops?
I mean, yeah, I think the short answer is yes.
I guess I don't want to put you on, I guess, in court, let's say, convicted.
Yeah, I you wouldn't run across them, like, you know, on the street or anything. I mean, you'd run into them in the process of criminal cases unfolding, right? So, you know, yes, the short answer is yes. I've seen law enforcement officers do things they shouldn't do that would be quote unquote dirty, to the point where, you know, I don't know if it's obviously nothing in the realm of what these two guys did, but, you know, conduct that would certainly classify as dirty. Yes, I've seen it.
This is two fascinating people, two disturbing people. And, you know, they're all kind of relating back to today because we see it in America. We're seeing it currently with the Derek Chauvin trial. We're seeing it with, you know, over the last basically 10 years in America, the level of not necessarily corrupt police, but police that have followed in the footsteps of other police. And it's really come to a forefront of just the level of unprepared and just how easy it is to become a cop. And I think ultimately it's one of the reasons that people like Louis Eppolito and Stephen Caracappa became what they were. And, you know, all of a sudden today, you know, no offense, but, you know, we're seeing it, Blackjack, with some of the things that play out in America. A lot of this has to do with people that are not prepared, people that are not put into the right situations, people that are bad people some of the time. Now, again, we're not saying every cop is bad, but you know, this has long been a disturbing issue. Now, when we get into the mob cops, when they were hired in the 70s, New York City was at basically a standstill. They needed to hire police officers. And I think, Blackjack, we're seeing it then and we're seeing it now. Sometimes these departments are going a little bit around the corner and maybe not necessarily figuring out all the steps because they're in such desperate need of officers.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a really good point, is that, I mean, you know, we sit back and, you know, listen, you and I have had conversations over the years. You know that I'm very critical when law enforcement oversteps because I think it's an incredible amount of power that you have and it needs to be exercised properly and judiciously. And when you abuse that, you should suffer severe consequences. But also the flip side to that coin is I wouldn't want to be a cop today. There's no chance I'd want to be a cop today because even if you're a good cop, right? Like, and let's be clear, most cops are good cops, right? They're trying to do their job and go home at the end of the night. Most of them are, but you know, I wouldn't want that job. Every single thing you do is going to be held under a microscope. And I'm sure there's going to be instances where you're totally authorized and justified and probably should act where you might hesitate. Like it's not a job I'd want today. And you're right. That's going to lead to maybe some of your higher end candidates looking to do something else. And what you're going to be left with may not be fantastic in some situations.
Now these two guys, you know, I've obviously spent many of my nights researching, you know, the mob and organized crime. And yeah, I've always said these are two of the most, this is one of the more interesting tales of mob history, just because, you know, you don't really come into contact necessarily with a lot of law enforcement in this racket here. You know, it's usually criminals. It's rare you see kind of it jump to another thing. But let's get into it. Let's talk about it. The mafia cops here on the sit down. Now, before we get into it, there's a couple of characters to kind of keep aware of in this sordid tale, if you will. Stephen Caracappa, Luis Eppolito, the mob cops, Anthony Casso, who is, you know, if you're familiar with the mob, he's no secret to you. They called him Gas Pipe. He actually just passed away recently. He passed away in December of 2020. But Gas Pipe was an underboss in the Lucchese crime family. A couple other guys as well, Burton Kaplan, who we'll get into as well. Let's jump into it. So basically, I'll start it out kind of with these guys and where they come from. Luis Eppolito was born July 22nd, 1948. He was from Flatbush in Brooklyn. He was raised in Brooklyn. And interestingly enough, Eppolito came from a mob family. His father, Ralph, was a jeweler. He was a player in the Gambino crime family. He wasn't made. He was more of an associate, but he did have a jewelry store, and he kind of moved around and I'm sure fenced material and things of that nature. His uncle and cousin were both made men in the Gambino crime family, serving under a guy, Nino Gaggi, who look, for many years, Anthony Gaggi was a capo. He was in the Mayo crew, was one of Paul Castellano's right-hand men. So, you know, these guys, the Eppolitos, were a fearsome bunch. They were guys that were not just associates. They were directly involved with organized crime. And Eppolito, as a young child, would see that. He would talk about that later in a book that he wrote about just being around it through his whole life. He growing up was a bodybuilder up in high school. He was kind of decided to get into that. And at that point he had won some contests and things, but that wasn't paying the bills. And Eppolito decided, you know what, I got to try to find a way to earn. And I guess at that point he decided, well, I don't want to go into organized crime. He had a connection through a friend that he was training to become a police officer. Decided, I'm going to go into the police department. I'm going to take the physical test. He passed the test and he applied in 1969. Now, Stephen Caracappa kind of took a different kind of journey to become a cop. He was born in 1941 and was raised in Staten Island. He actually growing up was friends with Thomas Bilotti, who, if that name rings familiar to you, who's Thomas Bilotti, Blackjack?
Tommy Bilotti was Paul Castellano's underboss who got shot with him outside Spark's Steakhouse. Yep. When John Gotti assumed control of the Gambino family. So that's an interesting link for some stuff we're going to hear about later.
Yeah, it was, you know, Castellano's driver for many years and yeah, was right there during the infamous Spark's Steakhouse hit. Growing up, there's a lot of unknown about Caracappa, but one thing we did know is he grew up pretty normal. Didn't have any mob connections outside of knowing Tommy Bilotti when he was a kid. But family were both, you know, mother, father were both, you know, working people. He kind of in his teens got into a little bit of petty crime. He did some burglaries and things like that. Actually stole some material from a construction site and was arrested. At that point, you know, he kind of skated out and you know, was a little, you know, teenage charge, basically. Basically, he decides to go into the military, served in the Army over in Vietnam, and all in all, kind of created, you know, outside of a few different things when he was a kid, he had a pretty normal childhood. And being in the Army, it kind of set him up to maybe go into a life of a police officer. Obviously, many police officers serve in the military. And that's when he decided to enroll as well. Now, at the time in the 70s and late 60s, when both of these guys decided to go into the police department, there was a major need in New York at the time. Blackjack, your father grew up in New York in, you know, in that time period. Yeah. Kind of as I would imagine, maybe not quite as old as these guys, but, you know, probably was born in the 50s and kind of saw that growing up. You know, New York was a mess. I mean, kind of in a way similar to today, where there's a lot of lawlessness, a lot of crime, and there was a need for officers.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you mentioned my father. You know, he was born in 1947, and so he remembers this time period very well in New York City. And, you know, he talks about it and he'll tell you, you know, unabashedly, it was a shithole, you know, and all he wanted to do was move out to Long Island because New York City was just, you know, it was rampant with crime in the 60s and 70s. I mean, it was not a good place. And really, it kind of stayed that way until Giuliani cleaned it up when he was the mayor. I mean, you know, you look at Times Square now, you go to Times Square, it's like an amusement park, right? I mean, it's all these stores and restaurants and different things.
It used to be a mess.
Back in the 70s, it was sex shops. I mean, like, yeah. You know what I mean? Like, that's what it was.
Yeah, The Deuce on HBO.
Right.
David Simon, he kind of pointed that out and did an entire, you know, show about it. But yeah, I mean, back during, you know, you mentioned the likes of Rudy Giuliani, who again was a crime crusader in his life. But before that, I mean, when guys like, you know, Ed Koch was the mayor and some of those guys, like, there was some bad things going on. And even into the 90s with David Dinkins. I mean,
yeah, David Dinkins. Yeah. Same thing. I mean, it really wasn't until Giuliani came in and cleaned up that city that it changed. I mean, New York City was not a good place for a long time.
Yep, exactly. Now, obviously, both these guys would be allowed into the department. Now, again, with Ippolito, really shouldn't have been allowed into the police department. Should have been precluded. Obviously, his mob connections were pronounced. Okay, it's not like this guy had, you know, his great grandpa, you know, two generations ago was a mobster in the 1900s. No, I mean, his parents or his father, his uncles, his cousins, they were all known made men in the Gambino crime family, which, again, you know, any police department, especially the New York City Police Department, all these high level departments, they do background on you, especially now. I mean, you look at what it takes to become a cop. They put you through a psychiatric exam. They go through your background. They go through things that should have precluded Ippolito from being a police officer. But again, needed cops. Brought him in, we'll give him a shot. You know, I guess you can always say, Blackjack, you can't, I don't know how you preclude someone from what other people do, but this was pretty pronounced.
Yeah, it's hard, right? Because, you know, you don't want to punish the son for the sins of the father, right? But
sure.
There are certain jobs of which are public trust positions that, like, you just can't do, right? I mean, like you said, like, you know, the Caracappa, he had, you know, that little theft charge and he's a teenager, whatever, no big deal, right? Like, it's a youthful indiscretion. Louis Ippolito was raised around mafia figures. Like, I mean, his father, his uncle, these are close relatives. And I know in 1969, they probably didn't do the level of screening that they do now. But I mean, Jesus, a simple background check would reveal these guys and what they are and who they're associated with. It just astounds me that Ippolito got the job.
Now, both these guys would obviously become officers. They would kind of lead into the police department. And, you know, during the 70s, did some great things in the police department. You know, Caracappa went into undercover work, then got into the organized crime homicide unit. He was doing some great things, become detective. And, you know, same with Ippolito. They were both distinguished people. And, you know, by the 80s, yeah, Ippolito was called a top 15 decorated cop in the city, arguably. So, you know, these are guys that were known to the higher ups. They were making moves in the department. But it wasn't until the early 80s where some things kind of started behind the scenes. Now, we mentioned Ippolito's connection to the mob. He had a cousin, Frank Santoro Jr., who was a associate in the mob. Santoro, who was kind of random how it was all connected, but he goes to prison, goes to Allenwood in Pennsylvania, federal prison, and meets a guy named Burton Kaplan. Now, Burton Kaplan was not an Italian. He was Jewish, but he was a connection to crime. You know, he was a jewel guy. He was in the garment district, did a lot of petty crimes, did a lot of things, and was known to mobsters. He worked with mobsters, did a lot of things. He was a Jewish mafia figure. And look, the Jewish mafia wasn't necessarily a thing, but throughout the years, Blackjack, whether it was Meyer Lansky, whether it was Arnold Rothstein, whether it was Louis Lepke, whoever, Jewish gangsters were very connected and have always been connected to the mobs. And while they're not made men or people that have high stature, there were a lot that played a huge role in the history of the mob.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point, right? Like, just because they're not technically made men doesn't mean they're not integral parts of the operation and heavily involved in things. So, yeah, I mean, Burton Kaplan is a guy who was ostensibly, I think, a tailor in the garment district, but realistically was every bit involved as these other guys we're talking about.
And one of Burton Kaplan's biggest rackets was he was a major drug trafficker. He was a big drug dealer, served, 20-ish years in prison at one point for drug dealing. Now, during one of his sentences, he meets Frank Santoro, I don't know, in the mess hall. Who the hell knows? They decide, they start talking. They both get freed, and Santoro basically tells Kaplan that he and his cousin speak a lot, and that his cousin would very much be willing to, share some information if they will. They would give info on informants, arrests, things like that for cash, whether it be Caracappa, who these two were partners at the time. So this is when it all kind of starts for Eppolito. He makes it known, hey, look, I'm making a ton of money. I'm a decorated cop, but I'm going to put all that up and sell information for money. Now, low level, illegal, but very low level. I agree, Blackjack, that this wouldn't put him away for life, but he would definitely be kicked off the force if this were found out.
Yeah, I mean, 100%, right? Like, you're right. It's probably not something that maybe you don't even do jail time over, but you're certainly losing your job.
Yeah, you're blackballed, basically. In 1984, the FBI, this is another name to keep an eye on, Rosario Gambino. The FBI raids a home owned by Rosario Gambino. Rosario Gambino, for anyone that isn't aware, you probably recognize the last name. He was a cousin of Carlo Gambino. He was a Sicilian mob member. He's actually from a family of three brothers, John, Giuseppe, and then Rosario. They came over from Palermo and settled in New Jersey. They were a part of the Gambino crime family, basically the Sicilian mob end of the Gambino crime family. They actually ran a family in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, and were overseen by the Angelo Bruno mob in Philadelphia. But they were a big-time mafioso. And in fact, John Gambino, who was kind of the head of the three brothers, he was actually one of the, as far as money's concerned, this guy made a ton of money over the years. And these Gambino brothers were big time players. I mean, they were doing big time things. And at one point, you know, he was appointed the boss of the Sicilian faction of the Gambino crime family by John Gotti. So these were big time players. So Rosario Gambino gets jammed up in a heroin case. And while they're raiding the home of Gambino, FBI agents recover police records and they pull some fingerprints, and guess whose fingerprints are on them? Lou Eppolito.
Yep.
So at that point they jam Gambino up and they basically suspend Eppolito without pay. 36 at this point, he's suspended without pay, has a family. And like we said, he would face termination. Now, he would go in front of a trial board and basically get charged with improperly copying and exposing police records and not fulfilling his duties as a police officer. The judge in the Gambino case gives Gambino 45 years in prison for smuggling heroin. But in 1985, somehow, Eppolito beats the rap, okay, and says that the judge basically said that although the fingerprints were on the records, there was no way to prove that Eppolito gave Gambino the records. So while they were in his office and in his house, Eppolito, maybe they were pulled from a filing cabinet and put there and planted there. But all in all, it was bullshit. Eppolito should have been pinched at that point. It should have been finished.
It's crazy. Like, Eppolito signed the records out of the police department. His prints were on the photocopies, not the originals, but the photocopies that wound up in Rosario Gambino's house. Like, there's no other explanation other than what? Some gloved man stole them from Eppolito and gave them to Gambino. Like, it's just so improbable that, like, and you got to remember too, we're not talking about a court of law, right? Like, this isn't proof beyond a reasonable doubt. This is a trial board within the New York Police Department. Yeah. Like, the fact that they looked at this and not only didn't fire him, but completely exonerated him and gave him like a glowing recommendation is just shocking. Like, it's shocking.
In fact, the trial board commissioner, Hugh Moe, yes, that's his real name, Hugh Moe, he made a quote and said that there was no evidence other than the detective Eppolito epitomizes the finest in the department as the unfortunate victim of circumstances, which, again,
victim. They called him a victim.
I mean, like, not for nothing. Hugh Moe, does he have blood on his hands for this?
I mean, 100%, dude. Like, think about it. At the very least, he was careless with records. If you believe his bullshit story, he's careless with important confidential records. That does not warrant a complete exoneration and saying that he's the finest we've got. If he's the finest you've got, you got problems.
Exactly. And by the way, this is not some random guy. This is a guy with known mob connection. The detective comes back. Eppolito's back. They give him over 10 grand in back pay. And he made a comment, nothing short of clearing my name could have replaced the tears my family cries over this. Eppolito is a storyteller. He is, he was, and he'll be proved to be his entire life. So they go back into the department and figure things out. Now, during this time, Caracappa was a part of the homicide unit based in Brooklyn, and both these guys were kind of using some inappropriate methods to figure things out. But it wasn't until the 80s, mid-80s, around the time when he gets jammed up, that they meet Anthony Casa. Now, Burton Kaplan, who kind of threw all these things and got this all this thing stuff going, Burton Kaplan introduces Eppolito to Anthony Casa. At that point, Anthony Casa is kind of always in a need for help. And look, any mob guy will tell you, you know, having police on your payroll is kind of normal. I mean, back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, that was a normal occurrence. So Casso kind of jumped at the opportunity to get to know these guys. In 1986, they decide we're going to link up. Casso actually called them his crystal ball. And he hired them in 1986 and was paying them $4,000 a month to give him police reports on probes and things like that. He would then get the information and kill informants or whatever. But I think to Eppolito and Caracappa's surprise, Casso wanted more. Anthony Casso, by the way, was a lunatic. If you asked me to list top 10 biggest lunatics in the history of the mob, Casso would be in that top 10. He was a known psychopath, did a lot of dangerous and terrible things. Now, look, a lot of mobsters killed, but I think Anthony Casso got to a point where he enjoyed killing people. He was a sick person, and we'll kind of discuss that. Burton Kaplan had an issue with, in 1986, a guy called Israel Greenwald. Greenwald was a diamond dealer. They had a beef. And he had a scheme where he was doing some treasury stuff, some schemes, and Greenwald Blackjack is someone that knew about the scheme. Kaplan becomes fearful that Greenwald will go to the police and says, hey, look, Casso, I need you to take care of this for me. This guy's got to go. In 1986, the Eppolito and Caracappa hit squad go out to attempt to find Greenwald. Now, they weren't going to kill him. They were just going to grab him up, and whatever happened after that wasn't under their control, I guess they thought. They find Greenwald, pull him over in a fake traffic stop. They take him to a garage, and waiting for him there is Frank Santoro, the cousin of Louis Eppolito. At that point, they leave, and Greenwald is never seen again. Blackjack.
Yeah, I mean, I think that these guys crossed the line from
that point on,
you know, taking documents and maybe sharing confidential information into murder very seamlessly, right? Like, I mean, that's a big leap, man. Like, it's one thing, like you mentioned, to have cops on the payroll, you know, where they're passing information, right? To kind of keep you one step ahead of what law enforcement's got. It's another thing to essentially just become a hitman. And I mean, these guys made that leap without as much as a blink of an eye. Like, it just seemed real easy to do.
Now, there was kind of a, and this kind of relates to the all the families, around this time in the 80s, in 1985, Gotti kills Castellano. That was very much shameful to a lot of the other families. We talked about it with Vincent Gigante in our first show. You know, Tony Corallo, the Lucchese boss, everybody was absolutely incensed that Gotti did this. So, you know, around these times, you know, Frank DiCicco was killed in an attempted hit on John Gotti. There was a lot going on. Now, obviously, an eye for an eye in the mob business, Frank DiCicco's killed. Many believe that Anthony Casso was the conspirator of that. So in 1986, Anthony Casso is basically people attempt to murder Casso. And in fact, he's sitting in a car outside of an associate's business where he's waiting, eating an ice cream cone, weirdly enough. I kind of envision that, Blackjack, a day like right? Where I'm at, it's sunny and 65 degrees. I envision Casso sitting in his Cadillac, maybe listening to a little Frankie Vale or something, and he's eating a cone, and two hoods come up and whack him or try to whack him. He somehow gets away, crawls into a local business. But as we know with Anthony Casso, you're not going to just try to kill him and get away with it. He tries to go to his cops and say, I need you to find out who did this shit. One of the persons that was named was a guy, Jimmy Heidel. Now, Heidel was a low-level mob associate. He was a, you know, known to police, did a lot of, you know, low-level crimes for the mob, was trying to get noticed. Casso finds out that Heidel was involved, and they are searched out. The two cops search him out. They find him in Staten Island at a home belonging to his mother and handcuff him. Basically, like, because again, it wouldn't be weird to see him get handcuffed because he was a criminal. And this is what worked out for these guys. They could always use, well, we're cops. We can arrest people. And then, you know, that's that. Heidel is basically taken into a car and taken to an unknown spot, and Anthony Casso is waiting for him. Now, Anthony Casso has admitted that he killed Jimmy Heidel. A lot of people believe that he was tortured and basically buried, and they never found his body. So by doing that, they awarded the cops with 40 G's. So that was another big-time moneymaker for them, and they had really jumped in with both feet. It's kind of like when you have to jump into a pool, Blackjack. You just kind of have to jump in. You know, 1 foot by another, it's going to take a while. You just got to jump right in. And these guys jumped right in. The Heidel murder, though, down the road would come back to haunt these guys, which we'll get into. One of the things that we've talked about is, Blackjack, they used a lot of their badge to get information. And one of the other folks that was involved in the attempted hit on Casso is Nicholas Guido. Nicholas Guido was a associate as well. Did a lot of things for the family. He was kind of a guy. He wasn't a made man or anything, but he was a guy. And Casso wanted to erase every person involved. I'm sure if there was someone on the street that had nothing to do with the mob, he would have shot them as well because they were close and didn't do anything about it. He was a real lunatic, Blackjack Casso.
Yeah, I mean, the guy seemed really paranoid, honestly. Like, he seemed worried about absolutely everyone around him. And like you said, his homicidal tendencies, as I think you said earlier, he seems like he enjoyed killing. It does kind of seem that way. When you combine that with a paranoia, it's not a great combination.
By this time, the mob cops are getting full of themselves. They're asking for more money to provide tips. Their prices are going up, as they say. They ask, Casso asked them to get some info on this Nicholas Guido guy. here's the issue. Nicholas Guido is a fairly normal name in mob circles. The name Guido, last name Guido, is a pretty normal name.
I mean, yeah, I mean, if you grew up in a place, you know, with a large Italian population like New York or Boston, you know, it's not sure. It's not like a shocking name to hear.
So he asked the cops to find information on this guy. It was known that Caracappa did go into the database to find out some info on Guido. The problem was Anthony Casso did not want to pay more money. He was on a rage and decided, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to go find this fuck myself. So he decides to do that. At that point, he locates a Nicholas Guido in Brooklyn. They send a hit squad to kill this guy. And on Christmas Day that year, Nicholas Guido is killed in his car. The problem was it was the wrong Nicholas Guido.
Yeah, it was.
By this time, Nicholas Guido, the actual Nicholas Guido, had went on the run. He had gotten word that Casso was looking for him, and he fled New York. The real Nicholas Guido was a teenager who was a telephone phone line installer. And basically, Casso killed the wrong guy. But Casso didn't care. Casso was a lunatic, as we said. And Kaplan basically said that if they had just done the mafia cops way, they probably would have found the right one and a guy would have been alive. But no one cared because, you know, that's just how it was.
Yeah, I mean, I think from the perspective of Caracappa and Eppolito, this was probably like the best result for them for business, because this next time you go to Casso and ask for more money, you can say, hey, remember that time you didn't use this and you killed the wrong guy?
Right. The prices went up. That's such a great point.
It's not the worst outcome for business.
No, not at all. And at this point, no one cared because he was just collateral damage, this kid.
Right.
And this is one of the – there are not a lot of innocent people that get killed by the mob. You know, again, I'm sure we could find them. You know, look, Sammy Gravano, the piece of shit that he is, he'll go and tell you that he only killed people in the mob. But Sam Gravano killed an innocent kid. He killed a 16-year-old. You can look it up. And, you know, these guys did as well. Casso was a scumbag in his own right. He killed someone that was innocent as well. In the late 80s, they were just killing everybody. There was hits involved. Now, but again, it's important to discuss. By this point, they had not actually killed anyone. They didn't pull the trigger themselves, right? They were giving info on these people, but they were not killing anyone. There were tons of people that turned up dead, though. An informant called John Heidel was killed. Bruno Facciola, Anthony DeLapi, all these guys were killed by Casso and or Frank Santoro on the information from the cops. In 1992, though, the mob cops get their break. There was a guy, Eddie Lino, who needed to go. Eddie Lino was a Gambino captain. And for anyone that doesn't know the name, the Linos were a group of brothers that were heavily involved with the Gambino crime family. Robert Lino, a brother of Eddie Lino, was involved in the late 80s, 90s, and even into the 2000s in some stock schemes with Joe Massino. He headed that triumvirate late after Eddie Lino. But one of the connections to Eddie Lino was, and this is back to the old connection between Caracappa and Thomas Bilotti. Many believe Eddie Lino was involved in the hit that John Gotti orchestrated. He was one of the six gunmen outside of Sparks. And a lot of people conspired to believe that this hit had a lot to do with that. But again, Casso wanted him dead as well. And in 1992, they pull Eddie Lino over on the Belt Parkway. They spot him, pull him over, and basically walk up to his car. Like they're going to pull him over like any cop would. Instead of asking for his license and registration, though, Blackjack, Caracappa shoots him 9 times. They leave and get 70 grand. So they killed him in broad nightlight, basically. Not daylight, but the Belt Parkway is a busy parkway.
You could drive the Belt Parkway 2:30 in the morning on a Wednesday and there's traffic.
Sure. It's not like no one saw this. No. It's pretty not very normal, but nobody said anything, and that was that. By this point, they were killers, okay? They weren't just co-conspirators. They were murderers. They had killed on behalf of the mob. They were going to jail for murder one if they got pinched. By, you know, the 90s, mid-90s, Karakop and Eppolito have gotten to their 20 and they both retire. They both decide that they're such good friends that they are going to move to Las Vegas together, which I got to admit, and I know you said it's very weird. It's definitely weird. I guess they had been good friends and partners. And not only did they move to Las Vegas, but they moved directly onto the same street.
Yeah. And that to me is just, listen, we all have people that we're really close with and like really good friends. And, you know, that's fine. But like these guys worked together for, you know, 20 something years. They were with each other every day.
Kind of want to leave them, I guess.
Then they retire. And not only do they move to the same city 2,000 miles away, but like you said, they move across the street from each other. It's almost like these guys were married. Like they literally spent every day together.
Yeah, one of the final murders they actually committed was Bruno Facciola, who was a member of the Lucchese crime family. Casso basically suspected that he was an informant, as a rat. Facciola is it's funny because I actually read this, that when the FBI found Facciola, he had a canary in his mouth, stuffed in his mouth. So that's kind of a message. It's almost like putting a fish on a car when you kill somebody, you know, sleep with the fishes.
Yeah, it's not subtle. It's not subtle.
No. And again, at this point, they were murderers. So they move out to Las Vegas and their lives kind of go different ways. Caracappa goes into the private investigation business. He also gets a job at a federal or at a women's prison. Yeah, they're both earning hearty pension checks by this point. We all know that New York pays well. You go out to Vegas, you can live real nice for the pension they're paying you. And those guys are making money. I actually remember, Blackjack, one of the final jobs I had before I went into the sports business that we're in now, I worked at a bank. And I remember there was a guy that used to come in. He was an NYPD cop. And he moved to where I live now in Pennsylvania. And he worked at a jewelry store. He was a security guy. He did security there. And I remember he would always come in and he would take his pension check out. And, you know, again, I'm not going to disclose what the guy made, but they make good money. They get a nice monthly amount. So the pension check is a nice connection. But these guys kind of go out and Caracappa decided, you know, I'm done. I'm going to go live my life now. Luis Eppolito, though, goes kind of a different way. He starts selling cars in an Infiniti dealership, and he would make it very known that he was a cop. He would talk about his life as a New York police officer, and the locals loved it as far as he was concerned. And weirdly enough, in 1992, which is the same year he murdered Eddie Leno, he writes a book called Mafia Cop, the story of an honest cop whose family was in the mob. Not very subtle, obviously, which is wild because in the book he details all sorts of things, you know, fighting for his reputation and avoid being dragged into the life. He basically admits to things that he did as a cop and before he was a cop, which is a wild move. I guess he just assumed that dumb, you know, idiotic enough that I guess they couldn't come back after him. But he also appears in several movies, including Predator 2, Lost Highway. And I know, though he has no speaking role, he is in Goodfellas. If you watch the movie back, he is the Fat Andy character, I believe is his name, in the movie. I actually do think he has a line. I think he says something like, what's up or something. I don't know. But either way, he was a mover and shaker as a low-level actor. He wanted people to know who he was. And I'd have to imagine, Blackjack, this enraged Stephen Caracappa.
I mean, it would enrage anyone with a goddamn brain, right? Like, I mean, listen, we talk about John Gotti and his impact on the mafia a lot, and you know, deservedly so. He's a huge figure in the public consciousness. But like, you would think after watching what being so public and brazen did to him, that you would have half a brain and just say, you know what? We got away with this. We're out in Vegas. Let's enjoy our lives, our retirement. But no, this guy is trying to go out there and get noticed and be in movies and write books with ridiculous titles. And it's like, dude, if I'm Caracappa, like, you've got to be like, what the fuck are you doing? Louis, shut up.
It was always the whole, why be a gangster if nobody knows who you are?
Yeah, I guess.
And, you know, during this time, and it's important to understand, like, just to look at these guys. When you look at these guys, Caracappa was a long, lanky guy, kind of skinny, looked like the brains, always dressed well, had a great, you know, set of specs on, always looked smart. Eppolito is more of a galoof, basically, kind of a pudgy guy. Always had his shirt unbuttoned, if you will. You could kind of tell who was the brains. So it was no surprise that Eppolito went the way he did. And again, Caracappa, I think, kind of assumed, you know, what the fuck are you doing? You know, shut the fuck up. You know, maybe we got away with this shit, but you're bringing attention to us. Around this time, as any good author does, Blackjack, any good promo guy does, when you do a show, you do a book, you do anything, you want to promote it, right? So at the time in the 90s, and I remember watching this, my mother would have it on when I was a kid, Sally Jesse Raphael, who for all you young people out there is basically the equivalent of like Ellen, not even Ellen. She would be like Wendy Williams or something.
Yeah, right. It was kind of like that was the era when like those daytime talk shows were really popular. Like,
and they would have like serious people too. It's almost like a Maury Povich, except a little.
It was
less.
It was a step up from that, and like a step down from Oprah. It was like you had like Oprah, Phil Donahue, you know,
Ricky Lake,
Sally Jesse, Ricky Lake, Montel Williams. It was like, you know, you'd have these weird random topics with a panel of people on there, and
they would do like, and it wasn't as trashy as like Jerry Springer, but like they would do like, we're going to interview Ku Klux Klan member or like someone, like, you know, weird. Stuff. Yeah. But again, people would watch it because it was interesting, I guess. I don't know. So Sally Jesse Raphael has Louis Eppolito on to talk about his book. And wildly enough, he goes on and he promotes his book and talks about how this and that happened and whatever. And funny enough, Blackjack, surprisingly to not many, a lot of mothers in America would watch Sally Jesse Raphael. And we'll talk about this in a second. An old connection to Eppolito pops up by seeing him on TV. By the 90s, you know, these guys were largely not in crime anymore, but there was some things still going on in New York at the time. Burton Kaplan, who, again, never really, you know, went away from crime, even up until his late years, was involved in selling marijuana and all sorts of different things. And again, I'm sure we hear selling marijuana. Look, in this time, marijuana was a narcotic and he was selling a ton of it. And Eppolito was still meeting with him. Eppolito would still take calls from Bonanno and Lucchese Crime Family Associates. He met with Kaplan in 1994. And by 1996, Burton Kaplan was arrested in New York on a connection to a marijuana ring and put into prison. Now, one thing has to be known about Burton Kaplan, and we see this all the time in the mob, not only to mob guys generally not cooperate, especially the older guys, but they hate informants. Burton Kaplan hated informants. He claimed he would never become an informant. And the DEA and FBI actually asked him about the suspicion that they had around these two guys, and he refused to talk. Several years later, we're into the 2000s, 2003. The case had grown completely cold. I mean, it was as cold as New York City in January, and nothing was being done. In 2003, there was a detective from the New York City Police Department, Tommy Dades, who, if you've ever watched mob documentaries, you've probably seen him. Clean cut, young guy from Brooklyn, knew a ton about the mob and has done some really extensive work. Kind of your detective that I think in the streets is almost not respected, but they know he knows what he's doing. You know, he knows how the mob life works and he's from that area. And he started examining some of the things that Eppolito and Caracappa had did. And in 2003, he gets a call from a woman named Betty, Betty Heidel. And Betty Heidel was the mother of Jimmy Heidel, that she had been watching Sally Jesse Raphael, and she saw Louis Eppolito on her episode. And she said, hey, something weird going on here in 86. I think that guy was the last person I saw my kid with. And by the way, my kid never came home. So Dades takes the evidence to the Brooklyn DA. And they kind of create a probe on these two guys. They then look at the records from the computer, find out that Stephen Caracappa's login was made searching Nicholas Guido. And weirdly enough, Blackjack, a month later, Guido disappears. So things started to come full surface. And it was a long time. Again, between 92 and 2003, that's 11 years. That case had grown cold since the book was written.
Yeah.
And I actually look back and I feel to myself and look at it and I say, could they have been found out? Maybe. Again, there wasn't any witnesses to these crimes, and that was the issue. That was the reason that the NYPD could never really do anything. There was no witnesses. The FBI had nothing. Where were they going to go? All these guys that they killed were dead. And unless they got a rat or somebody with legitimate information, they weren't going to find these guys.
Nope.
In 2004, though, is when the big break came, and for the mob cops, was the beginning of the end. In 2004, a witness decided that he didn't want to go to jail anymore. He didn't want to be in prison anymore. By this point, he was in his 70s and said, you know what? I'm done. I'm not going to live out my final days in prison. I have a daughter. I have a grandson or granddaughter. I have grandkids. A good old Burton Kaplan decides that he's not going to stay silent anymore. He had been in prison for 8 years and wanted to live out Blackjack his golden years in peace.
Yeah, I mean, he did. It's ironic for a man who was so staunchly against people turning government's evidence that he ultimately did it himself. But that seems to be the trend with some.
He would outline basically years of information that he was provided from the mob cops and the crazy ways this info would go, whether it was killing informants, whether it was killing themselves. And a federal judge, grateful for Kaplan, decides that he can get out of jail. And he's basically let out. Burton Kaplan would die 5 years later in 2009 at the age of 75. So did get a few years out. Spent a lot of life in prison. And, you know, this is always the growing sentiment of anyone involved in the mob, whether it's Burton Kaplan or it's John Franzese or, you know, John Gotti or whoever. You die alone and you die just like everybody else. Nobody knows who the hell you are. And that's, you know, weirdly enough, Blackjack, and we'll get kind of to the end of this. But one thing I always pointed out, a lot of people hate The Irishman, the movie, right? But I think the last 30 minutes is the best in a movie I've ever seen. That kind of period in the movie where Frank Sheeran, who's played by De Niro, he kind of realizes that his life is completely over and that he basically ostracized everyone important to him, including his family and his kids and everybody, for something that at the end of it all, he got very little acknowledgement for. And if you remember in the movie, he's really old. He's in like that nursing home and the woman that's caring for him, like sees a picture that he's holding and he goes, do you know who this is? And she goes, yeah, I know who it is. And he goes, Jimmy Hoffa? He goes, you don't know who Jimmy Hoffa is. And she goes, yeah, you're right, I don't. And we like connecting this all back, she didn't know who Jimmy Hoffa was. She didn't know who Frank Sheeran was. She didn't know who any of these guys were. And at one point, Jimmy Hoffa was the most noticeable man in America, probably. But Sheeran basically realized that in the end, all you have is your family. And he didn't have that, and he died alone. And I think Burton Kaplan basically decided, you know what? It's 2006 or 2005, whenever this was. What the hell? Who the hell am I protecting? I mean, Anthony Casso by this point had flipped. There was no honor left. This wasn't the 50s or 60s anymore. And if I can go and live the last couple of my years out in solitude, so be it.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, right? I get it. Like, I understand the logic of it. It's just ironic to me that a guy who had this, like, strong belief that this was not the way to go, you know, ultimately wound up doing it. I mean, but you're right. It was at a time when people were flipping left and right, so.
As we know about, as anyone will tell you about prison, you got a lot of time to think. And sure do. A lot of time, all you have to think about is your own thoughts. In March 2005, Louis Caracappa and or Luis Abuelito, Stephen Caracapa were arrested and charged with racketeering, obstruction of justice, extortion, 8 counts of murder, and conspiracy. These murders included Jimmy Heidel, Nicholas Guido, John Heidel, John Doe, Anthony Lappi, Bruni Facciola, Eddie Lino, and Bobby Borriello, and their involvement in the conspiracy to murder not only Burton Kaplan, but Sammy Gravano, who many people aren't aware of. Sammy Gravano was obviously someone that Anthony Casso hated and wanted to kill. He had the obviously the connections to the John Gotti hit, and they wanted him dead. By this point, Anthony Casso had kind of flipped his guts as well, and he was telling his story. He actually, in 1998, Blackcheck went on a 60 Minutes piece with Ed Bradley and said that he had two cops. And the problem at that point was they had no info. They had no they had no evidence. And by that point, Casso was revolved as a you couldn't believe anything he did. In 2006, the presiding judge in the case, Jack Weinstein, did throw out some things. But at that point, the trial started. And funny enough, in 2006, both Eppolito and Caracapa during the trial claimed that they were being discriminated against during the proceedings. Caracapa goes on 60 Minutes himself and talks about how great he is and he never would do any of this stuff. And I will admit, Blackjack, if I knew nothing about Stephen Caracapa, and I mean this, I wouldn't lie to you, I actually believed a lot of things he said. Honestly, he came across very believable. That he would never do anything like this. Either he was a great actor or he was just a complete lunatic. Have you ever seen the 60 Minutes he did? Because he comes across believable to me.
Yeah, he does. And I think that Caracapa, I mean, listen, you can't absolve him of what happened, but I think that Eppolito is clearly the ringleader here.
Sure.
Like, I think Eppolito is the guy driving this train.
Until you find out that Caracapa pumped 9 bullets into Eddie Lino.
Yeah, I mean, at that point, it's tough to say he's anything other than a sociopath, but I do think that if you're looking at the two of them, you probably have the dominant personality in Eppolito.
Yeah, and, you know, interestingly enough, in 2009, the trial, you know, they had been convicted, the verdict was in, they were guilty. In 2009, on March 6th, Luis Eppolito was sentenced to life imprisonment plus 100 years, and Caracapa got life plus 80 years, each were fined more than $4 million. And I think that plus 80 years was maybe a little kind of throw to the courts that Eppolito was the ringleader. They both get life, but Eppolito got the worst punishment of them all. And on July 23rd, 2010, all the convictions were upheld by the Second Circuit Court, and they were done. At sentencing, Luis Eppolito had a quote saying that the federal government can take my life. I'm a man. They can't take my soul, my pride, or my dignity. I'm a hardworking cop. I never hurt anybody. I never kidnapped anybody. I never did any of this. And throughout their entire life, and even on trial, not only did they discuss they were innocent and pled for help, but they said they were discriminated against. No one ever admitted to what they did. Caracapa was incarcerated at USP Coleman in Florida. He was then transferred to North Carolina, to Butner, where he died of cancer in 2017. Eppolito, Blackjack, served a sentence at the USP Tucson, which is a high-security federal prison. I also believe, from what I know about USP Tucson, there is a cop wing there, from what I understand, of some sort. It's kind of one of those prisons where they have a lot of I believe, from what I understand, Larry Nassar's there as well. I think there's some wings in USP Tucson where they put some really bad people that have kind of terrible crimes that aren't necessarily drug trafficking or things like that. In 2019, Luis Eppolito died in a Tucson hospital in federal custody. No one has disclosed his cause of death. Now, Luis Eppolito was a overweight, probably in pretty poor health in his own right. So we'll take it. But both have died and both have passed. But it really continues to state the kind of treachery that, look, Anthony Casso did, but we knew that. Burton Kaplan was a criminal. But these were guys that on the surface were not criminals until we look at them. And they were every bit as dangerous as any other mob guy. By the end of it, they were mob men, and they were probably and should have been made men. You have to wonder, maybe they should have just went into this from the beginning. They both had some connection. You have to wonder, Blackjack, if Caracappa just said, you know what, Tommy Blotti, let's create a crew and let's do this our own way. And Appolito, hey, I'm going to follow my dad's footsteps. What turned on to them that they should be cops? You know, it's interesting. You
have It is. And it's one of those things that, you know, you'll never know ultimately at this point. But, you know, like you said, you know, they went down the road of being cops, but it didn't last very long. I mean, they turned into full-fledged gangsters at some point. So
throughout the trial, New York City paid over $18 million to settle 7 different lawsuits brought by families of the victims of Caracappa and Appolito. This was a huge stain. And look, this is the department that has had corruption. If you know anything about the 7-5 precinct in Brooklyn, they had all sorts of corruption in the 80s with drug dealers. I mean, there have been plenty, you know, even into the 90s and things like that. But none as bad as the mob cops. They were terrible, disturbing people who killed many. And as I said, we knew Casso was a mob guy. We knew he was dangerous. But when you disgrace the badge to this level, it's really something that should have been prevented from the start. And I mean, you could probably make the case that neither should have been cops, but particularly Appolito. And you have to ask yourself, Blackjack, currently in New York City, the police department, there are, I think, about 36,000 sworn officers. In the 70s. There were probably, I don't know, at least 20 or 25. You have to wonder how these two met each other in a department that big. These two find each other. Fascinating. Yeah,
it's almost like a love story, man. Honestly, like it's like fate that they found one another and wound up, you know, living this life together. Obviously a life of crime, but also just living their lives together. I mean, like that's what they did. So yeah, it's an odd story.
Yeah. And in final, kind of some news today. And I remember when I was at Barstow, I blogged about this. Terrence Winter, who created Boardwalk Empire, which is one of the great shows in the history of TV, was a writer on Sopranos. He actually has picked this story up to become a TV show, I believe, some sort of true crime series. It's going to be called something along the lines of Mafia Cops, but they're going to get direct consultation from Tommy Dades, the detective that kind of broke this case, some prosecutors. And I would probably imagine from some of the direct victims of this case. So, you know, this is kind of an untitled project, but this is going to be something that's going to be brought to the big leagues. And, you know, sadly enough, and this is always kind of the stain of the mob. Sam Gravano is going to be a consultant on this project.
Of course he is.
Look, listen, here's what I will say about Sam Gravano. And this is the last thing I'll say. Sam Gravano is a piece of shit. He's a scumbag, fuck, rat piece of shit. But at the end of the day, I think Sam Gravano will say this. I'm out and you're not to a lot of these mob guys. And you look at his life. Should he be out even though he killed 20-ish people? No. But, you know, he's made a career out of it. And this is where we are.
He's out, but he's back in pretty frequently because the guy's out there dealing, what, ecstasy out in Arizona.
Yeah, but now look at him. He's making taxable income with a YouTube channel and laughing all the way to the bank. He's going to be on projects like this. And, you know, at the end of the day, I think the one sickening thing you see about people like Gravano is, and one of the reasons that I'm glad we're doing this show is to, I think, almost set the record straight. I have no connections to these people. But I think it's important to discuss facts. And Sam Gravano is not a hero, okay? People in the comments talk how great he's a terrible individual. He's an awful person. He's a complete turncoat, canary, rat, fuck, and needs to be talked about in that light. He's a scumbag, and everybody needs to know it. But he's going to make some money off this new drama. And from what it looks like, it's going to be on Showtime. I'm looking forward to this because, again, I loved – Boardwalk Empire. He won some stuff with the Sopranos, wrote some great episodes there. Let me ask you before we go, Blackjack, let's try to think of who plays these guys. Who do you think plays these guys?
An interesting one. It's tough, man, because the actors that are out there today don't fit these roles perfectly, right? Like, I mean, you know, I look at Caracappa and I think like Al Pacino 20 years ago would have nailed it, right?
You know, actually, I actually have two, if you would like to hear it.
Do it.
And I'm not, these just literally just popped into my head. You watch The Sopranos.
Yeah, of course.
Christopher plays Caracappa.
Yeah, that could work.
And Bobby plays Eppolito.
Yeah, that's not bad. Michael Imperioli could definitely do
Caracappa. And Steve Schrippa did, and they actually do a podcast about Sopranos right now. Yeah,
that's not bad. That's not bad. I could see both of those in those roles.
Because at the end of the day, when you put something like this out, you have to – I know people like get sick of seeing like the same guys, but that's what makes these shows great because they – you can't put like an Irish guy to play an Italian. Like you can't do it. Like that's why Sopranos was great because the actors were Italian. They looked like the characters. Like,
yeah, you have to. It's got to be authentic.
So yeah, I'm going to go Imperioli and Schrippa to play Caracappa and Eppolito.
That's not bad.
Let's look forward to that. But there you go. The Mafia Cops, Louis Eppolito and Steven Caracappa, two disgraced people. But, say it for what it is. It's a fascinating story. That's that for the show this week. We hope you enjoy it. We hope you enjoy the show. Please subscribe. Please comment. Please give us 5 stars. We're trying to build something here. Coming up, we've got some great content coming at you. We're actually next week going to get into non-Italians. We're going to get into the Philadelphia Black Mafia, a shady underworld group that extend deep into today. And I'll talk about that next week. Just do you know anything about the Black Mafia, Blackjack? Or
not a lot, Jeff. So I'm looking forward to doing some research on it and learning some things.
Yeah, they have major connections to the Nation of Islam, who today are in the news with some of their behavior. And, in my opinion, are some of those dangerous people in the history of Philadelphia. And we'll get into that as well. We got all sorts of different people. If you have someone you want us to break down and do a show about, make sure you reach out. As we build the show, we'll get into some Q&As. We'll do some mob movie reviews soon. Maybe we'll do something with that. Great stuff, Blackjack. Thanks as always.
Yeah, brother. Looking forward to it.
We'll see you next week here on The Sit Down, a Mafia.